Welcome to another episode of New Books and Poetry. I am your host, John Ebersole, and I am delighted to be joined by the poet Adam Fitzgerald. Adam was born in Staten Island and raised in New Jersey. He attended Boston College and Columbia University and is founding editor of the poetry journal Maggie. He currently teaches creative writing and literature at Rutgers and the New School, and he currently lives in New York City. Adam Fitzgerald, welcome to New Books and Poetry.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be talking over, I guess they're not the radio waves, but they're the podcast waves.
They are waves, though, for sure. Hey, I got to ask you, I usually don't do this, but I promised Don Scher of Poetry Magazine that I would ask you about the poems that you have appearing soon in poetry. Is that true, that you have some poems coming out there?
Yes. I'm very happy about three poems I have. They're all new, obviously. I think the titles are Poem with Accidental Memory, a poem called George Washington, and a poem called Time After Time, which was actually inspired by Timothy Donnelly was asking different poets, since it's the 30th anniversary of Cyndi Lauper's album that song appears on, everyone he wanted to write a poem based upon the title from that album. So I think the album is She's So, you know, you have to bear in mind I'm not a Cyndi Lauper fanatic, sadly, but I know some of her songs and I love them very much. But I guess the album is called She's So Unusual. And so one of the songs on it that I've always loved, especially for its music video, is Time After Time. So he wrote to 10 different poets or 9 different poets, and he kind of, you know, said, why don't you take this song, or are you interested in doing this? And I said, oh, Time After Time will definitely be the one for me. So I, not knowing the lyrics to it very well, I kept on replaying the song at a very low volume on my computer.
Mm-hmm.
And what phenomenon that I think we all do is you process the song and you kind of sing along without really knowing what you're saying.
Yeah.
And what I did is I tried to almost homophonically write the lyrics that I thought I might have been hearing. but I purposely kind of played it at such a low volume that I kind of crazily just had to make up whatever I thought the lines were again and again and again. So,
gosh.
Yeah.
And did Don Scher know these procedures you were taking?
I don't know if he does, but I guess he liked the results. But the poem does have a subtitle or whatever that says after Cyndi Lauper. So
yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because a lot of your poems and The Late Parade, you know, attribute a lot of inspiration from other work and stuff. Is there kind of, you know, I never thought about it, but, you know, a lot of poets are, you know, a lot of poets just kind of, you know, derive a lot of things from other work. Is there some ethical standard about how much we poets, like, need to mention where we get stuff from? Because some things will say that, you know, we'll say, oh, this is indebted to, and then something a little more, just a more direct is, like, this has been appropriated or this has been altered. You know, is that something, like, what's your thought about, like, having to say that? Is that just, like, kind of a out of respect kind of thing, or that it leads the reader, like, breadcrumbs back to a source that you might want them to check out anyway?
Yeah, I think it's more, I mean, I think each poet is different. For me, it was certainly about wanting kind of to lead a breadcrumb trail.
Yeah.
You know, my publisher wanted me to meet a certain page count, and I figured, oh, well, the first thing I can do is, you know, add some notes at the back of the book. And then, of course, the notes became so ridiculously involved and detailed.
Yeah.
And it almost became an absurdity to me to start listing or not listing different references.
Right.
And I just kind of allowed myself to go with it, realizing that, you know, nearly all of the the references I mention or talk about are genuinely elements of the kind of the process of how those poems came about. But I think at the same time, it's kind of a way of controlling the context of how your work might be received, mm-hmm. or at least influencing or manipulating that process for the reader. Because, you know, there's as many things that maybe I didn't include as I did. Now, I'm not necessarily a poet that wildly reproduces other people's work without altering it in some way. Though, obviously, that is, as I think today, legitimate in a poetic practice as anything else. And, you know, obviously with the grand attention conceptualism and just, you know, I think we're all living in this kind of echo chamber of appropriation and stealing and crediting. And to what degree is, you know, you're saying, to what degree is it about ethics, or is it about kind of just distraction or evasion? I don't know, but it's definitely a good question.
Yeah, it reminds me of, you know, like Goldsmith. I was just reading through him recently, and he said, like, I don't know, he made some claim, like, you know what, we have enough text. You know, I mean, it was a radical kind of, you know, like, claim, but he's like, you know what, we got enough text, we're good to go, let's just kind of reuse what we got. And I don't think you're saying that at all, but yeah, it is weird. Like, I like what you said, because we're all kind of drawing influences in our poems. It's like, well, where do I stop attributing, like, you know, like, well, this was sort of inspired by my reading, but I didn't, like, really take anything. So I don't know. I think that's always just kind of interesting to me. And I wonder if readers how readers take the idea of appropriate, like if they, you know, if they read through your book and then suddenly like, oh, wow, this has all been like, you know, a lot of it's, you know, I don't know. Like, there's this romantic idea of like the purity of just like, oh, the poet. But I guess that's just kind of like not even historically accurate anyway, because all poets have been kind of borrowing little things here and there from everyone. I wanted to ask you before we get into the book, which I think I described in an email to you as a berserk love song, and I'm totally sticking by that.
I welcome that.
Oh, it really is. It's, I don't know where it is. It's interesting because the way you described the Cyndi Lauper kind of procedure of writing that, like, I sometimes get the sense that the page, like just the physical page, is almost sometimes inadequate to the energy you seem to be trying to put on it. Like, so I could see where the, just the physicality of the page and jumping out into like a tad procedural something there or something conceptual there kind of is a matter of disposition for you. I've always kind of wondered that about too, about poets who seem to are very steeped in kind of these kind of artistic practices that go beyond just writing, but then kind of apply those things into their writing. I don't know if it's dispositional, like maybe there's just some lyric poets that just are satisfied with not doing that. I don't know. But I want to back up. You were born and raised in Staten Island. Is that correct?
Born, but not raised. In Staten Island, but I grew up in New Jersey.
Right, you grew up in New Jersey. And what part of New Jersey?
A town called South Brunswick, which is about equidistant between New Brunswick and Princeton.
Yes, I know it. I used to live in New Jersey. Are you familiar with Cranford at all?
Yes, I am. One of my first poetry teachers, Joe Weil, who's currently a professor at Binghamton, and was a huge influence and still a very dear friend on my kind of my whole creative life. He lived in Cranford until he moved to Binghamton to become a professor there. So I know Cranford pretty well.
Yeah, yeah.
Beautiful town.
It really was. It was a nice little town. And when I was at Columbia, that's where I lived and I was commuting all the time. It was kind of a heck of a commute, but, so tell me about kind of growing up in Jersey. I mean, when I was in Jersey, I would tell people like I live there, but I found it like extremely kind of like down to earth, and people would think I was crazy. But I don't know. I found like the vibe there really good. What was it like growing up there? And did you have like what was your family life like? Did you have brothers or sisters or anything?
I had an older brother. I think that I had a pretty happy childhood.
Mm-hmm.
But it is I kind of formulate this simply, but I think for a long time, you don't really assume that where you come from or where you grew up, based upon what kind of a writer you are or what kind of a poet you are, might have that much of an influence on your life.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly know that New Jersey was something that didn't seem to me self-consciously anything. It didn't seem interesting. It didn't seem not interesting. It just seemed like home. And so for me, it was kind of this background scrim that I just wanted to kind of replace or trade in or outgrow. And it hasn't been really until lately where I've been living in the city for at least, I guess now, almost 4 years. And before that, Boston and then Hudson, New York. And I visit home where my family still lives there. And just over Thanksgiving, I kind of frequented some of the malls that I spent a lot of my time there with, going with my family or friends. And I started to realize how much New Jersey has been such a kind of shaping influence on me. And I think it's one of those things that you can only really understand to the degree that you're away from it or it's the past.
Yeah.
You said that you felt like it was a very down to earth place. I feel like it's the most down to earth place on the whole planet.
Yeah.
You can't get more down to earth. And culturally is a weird word to maybe think of it that way. It seems somehow artificial or, if not pretentious, just wrong. But, in some ways, New Jersey feels like, the fact that it is so close to New York and at the same time it's not New York.
Yeah.
It has this very weird sensation of kind of, it's the place where, New York meets the rest of the country. And in some ways it kind of feels like the suburbs of New Jersey feel like the suburbs of what a suburb should mean in America. But obviously that's an illusion or something that sounds ridiculous to say. But it is, malls, mini malls, highways, and neighborhoods and developments and good schools and pollution and people forget how it's also a pretty state. I think when people think of New Jersey, they tend to think of maybe the Garden State Parkway and the fact that we have density and more Superfund sites than probably anywhere else.
I think you encapsulated Jersey pretty well there. I remember living there, and I like that you said that you always felt the presence of New York City just looming over that place. Which was in part enticing because you knew you could get to it quickly. But it did. It had a strange dynamic on the place. And then you mentioned the malls. I think I saw online you were taking pictures from Menlo Park Mall. Is that right?
Yeah, I was taking pictures from Menlo, but I was also taking pictures at Lawrenceville. And, malls recently have become so fascinating to me, I think, because they've become nostalgic. I mean, I don't really visit malls, and I can't really think of wanting to be in one, even if I was back home and living in New Jersey. But
yeah.
Because I've spent so much time there and I kind of associate them with my childhood a lot, going back to them and and kind of realizing, oh, this is what people did before the internet. It kind of really caught something with me. And recently someone posted something online about a photographer who has published this book of kind of candid photographs that he took throughout the 1980s.
I saw that. That was crazy, right?
And it was just absolutely, I can't explain it. It was absolutely riveting.
It was.
There was something about seeing a picture of someone in 1980s fashion walking in and out of a Spencer's Gifts that almost felt to me like a close-up of the Parthenon. I don't know how to explain.
No, I think that's perfect because I just, I want to kind of jump off that point you're talking about. This is going to sound really bizarre, but I run this writing group for very elderly nuns. Don't ask me to explain.
Wow.
I'm not even kidding. And I met with one of them yesterday and she wrote this little piece about, she grew up in Philly and the Sears Roebuck building was like this visual marker to where in proximity to where her home was. And so over and over throughout her childhood, she would see the Sears Roebuck building. And then one day, without warning, it was torn completely down. And how her sense of where her home was completely disruptive. But I was thinking, too, while she was talking about it, because another sister was there, and they had this little back and forth about Sears. And the recollection they were having about this little department store was one that was not cynical, that it was one of like a great remembrance of it. And they, like their memory of it was not clouded by phrases like late capitalism or, you know, consumerism and just like, you know, just that whole kind of culture where like, I think a lot of people wrestle with on a daily basis that we're constantly being asked to part with our money for things we don't need. And here were these older ladies just sitting there talking about Sears as something that completely a part of the texture of their life in which textured enough in which genuine human meaning could adhere to it. And yet at the same time, it was just a department store. It was something like cropped up by our economy. And yet they were having such visceral identifications with it. And when you were talking about kind of the mall for you, when you were talking about the Menlo Park Mall and then seeing those photographs from the past, how, you know, there was an innocence to like, maybe it was like a pre-internet thing, but like, not this like dark cynicism about consumerism. Like the mall was just a place. You know, like, it was just not like there wasn't something sinister about it. It was like, you know, I mean, it is a social space in which no political speech is allowed, really. But, you know, like, I don't know. Your rendering of the mall had a hint of the same innocence those sisters were talking about, the Sears. And do you think people's, like, attitudes about, like, this consumerism thing have changed?
Yeah, it has. And I think what's perhaps misleading or deceptive about it is that I think sometimes people feel like they can discuss or think about consumerism almost as if they could like isolate oxygen as an element of every other compound that makes up. I mean, I don't know chemistry, or maybe I mean hydrogen, but you know, what it means to be a consumer is, so intricate and wedded to everything that we do in this culture, whether we're shopping or not. And that doesn't mean that I think people shouldn't be critical or cynical about different spaces and who's controlling those spaces and what is allowed or not allowed or kind of what are the expectations. But, you know, if you live in America, if you produce and you buy and you shop and you browse, these are kind of very fundamental. They're kind of what it means to be alive. And they end up kind of fusing with, I guess I have nothing more interesting to say about it, but it just feels to me so intricate.
Yeah, no, I think what you're saying,
everything.
Yeah, no. I'm kind of catching on to what you're saying, is that we can't sit there and divorce our own personal narratives, and that we have genuine experience and emotion that are fundamental to the way we see ourselves and the stories we tell ourselves. And those stories happen to happen in very, capitalist or consumerist spaces. And like,
absolutely.
You can be in a mall and have your first kiss with someone, just because you're in a mall. And I think I think you're right to say it. It's hard to, like, sometimes we want to tease out, like, oh, malls suck, but actually we can't escape that. We have lived our meaningful lives in these spaces.
And you can be in a mall and have your first cinnamon with somebody. those are divine experiences.
I know, isn't that crazy? But we're like, do you think there's like a shame or guilt that this is the stage in which some of those little signposts in our memories happen? Or do you think we can like embrace it? I mean, it's so easy to like just single out consumerism and just be like, oh, it's just spiritually crushing. But it's like, hey, it's also where we live our lives every day. And I always find that, we've talked about it a lot, but that intersection of meaningfulness with the intellectual knowledge of like, wow, this is a giant crazy system that is doing all kinds of nefarious things to human beings across the globe. It's really like a conundrum of being an American in many ways. It's like, how can I live a meaningful life on a stage that I didn't help build? Or I don't know. I think we've kind of fleshed out this kind of strange contradiction to the American identity. But it's interesting. I think it affects a lot of poets and different ways. So you're growing up in Jersey. And you, when you're in high school, where can we situate when poetry like really kind of latched on to you? Was that in high school, middle school, or where can you pinpoint that?
Well, I can remember writing poems in as early as fourth or fifth grade, and kind of always thinking I wanted to be either an actor or a writer. But in high school, I definitely kind of was bit by the writing bug, and I took a creative writing class, and a student there told me about this program that the county paid for, and that's why they didn't, I guess, really advertise it too well, where you could apply to leave your regular high school one day a week and meet up at this community center and meet up with other artists in your discipline. They had dance, they had music, they had jazz, they had lots of different things, painting. And there was one for poetry. And so I auditioned for this program, and I got in, and I was able to leave my school my senior year one day a week to go study poetry with a professional poet and kind of meet other people my age who were interested in poetry. And that was, I felt like, a very decisive experience in my life, because I was around people who were kind of like-minded, and even if we weren't very well-read, we were very hungry to be so.
Yeah, that's really incredible that they offered that. So when you graduate from high school, you went to Boston University, was it?
Boston College as an undergraduate.
And oh, man, I probably just later. Insulted you, didn't I?
No, not at all. I went to BU lovingly for a master's afterwards. But
maybe that's what I was thinking of. Yeah, so you did your undergraduate at Boston College and then Boston University. That's what I'm actually thinking. So what was your time? What drew you clearly to Boston? And what was your kind of, how was your undergraduate experience?
It was good. I what drew me there was the fact that I accidentally got accepted, and I followed up on that offer to a good school. And I I met incredible professors, Paul Mariani, who's a noted American poet and scholar and biographer, and just great lover and teacher of English and American poetry, and very literary, and others, including a press named Tom Epstein, who you know, spoke six or seven different languages, and knew Russian literature, German literature, inside and out, and that was just incredible to kind of be exposed to people who had kind of a lifelong devotion to this art that I wanted to kind of obsess over, get involved with, and somehow do something with.
Yeah. Did you get a sense then about your own sensibilities as a poet? Were you starting to get blown away by some poets and you didn't read other poets?
I mean, I think I always wanted, I think my initial disposition was always towards, I wanted a kind of heightened language, something grandiose, something that just kind of felt like a altered state of being or consciousness. And I was really drawn to kind of art that just felt completely different from who I was and what I had experienced. And so when I began reading Yeats, and kind of just through the luck of the draw, because I had done a presentation on The Second Coming in high school and I enjoyed it. And so I started reading his collected poems. I started reading his plays. I read a biography about him by Richard Ellman, which is a classic. And I started reading Harold Bloom's monograph on Yeats. And Bloom is a great, I think he's a great person to read at any age, but he's particularly great if you're young and you're trying to be exposed to where, how you can kind of flesh out or carve a sensibility for yourself. Because he's such a kind of great intertextual mind and obsessive. And so from that point, I could kind of, you know, discover Keats and Dickinson and Hart Crane. And these are people that just meant everything to me and kind of still do.
Yeah, I was just talking to Angie Malenko the last interview I did, and we were talking about that kind of tension between the plain spoken vernacular, the colloquial, versus, you know, that kind of more the rhetoric with voltage and more Baroque. Do you have any, like, you know, I mean, is there, I guess it is a sensibility, but I was kind of thinking, because I'm sympathetic to your sensibility in the sense of, like, I want language to kind of, like, charge me out of the ordinary, where there's kind of, like, this also a counter idea that, like, you know, that language should be, you know, completely kind of talking to the reader in a way that the reader is okay with on the street level. Do you just kind of, do you have any thoughts on that? Or is it just a matter of, like, hey, I knew what direction I was moving in with that?
Well, I think I definitely was following something that I just had in me, maybe. But I know one of the first classes I took was a graduate seminar, actually, that Mariani taught on Stevens and Williams. And what a great pairing in American poetry to kind of see these very different modes between the kind of the abstract and the particular, the vernacular, the rhetorical. And, you know, I just found myself kind of frustratedly uninspired by much of Williams, and being kind of young and hot-headed and narrow-minded. And I think there is a kind of necessary narrowness in artists almost always, but particularly when you're young and you're trying to look for permission to do what you don't even know what it is you want to do yet. So I just, you know, Stevens was kind of, it felt like home. Not because, and that sounds, it just felt like that's what I guess I had always thought I had wanted a poem to be like.
Exactly.
And, but, you know, as I've kind of hopefully grown and expanded my taste and become a lot more Catholic and sympathetic and kind of, contrapuntal enough where I can kind of, become interested in what poets are doing, especially because they're not something that I particularly feel drawn to innately. You know, I'm fully aware of the worthiness and the seriousness of that aesthetic that Williams is in one way indicative of, you know, and it wasn't until really I had read through, James Schuyler's work, which I love, that I realized how, you know, I mean, Williams influenced and irrigated so much of 20th century American poetry.
Yeah.
You know, that was just a concrete example for me of, you know, there wouldn't have been the Schuyler that I love without, you know, kind of Williams working in those kind of short, kind of very observational based poems.
Yeah. No, I think you put that great. And I wanted to, I'm kind of jumping forward to your founding of Maggie. Did you find, you know, it's interesting that you said maybe it's a youthful quality when you just kind of like are looking for that identity and you latch on to what feels exactly right to you, and then kind of swing around later to work that's actually not like yours and be able to appreciate it. Did that come about with editorial work, or do you just attribute that to just kind of like kind of growing up?
I think I kind of contribute it to growing up, and I think it's definitely a prerequisite to be a decent or worthwhile or even, I dare say, honest editor.
Yeah.
You want to be able to know the difference between what you're looking for and what other people might also be looking for. And I think as you kind of, at least for me in my experience, as I felt more secure with my preferences and my tastes and kind of understanding how they fit into things, I also grew more charitable to other people's preferences and tastes because I didn't feel like I had to to understand what I was after.
Right. You didn't use antagonism towards other styles to have to understand your own. You already understood your own, and therefore what other style would be threatening when you are interdirected like that. So I wanted to ask you about Boston University because can you tell me the name of that master's program you were involved with there?
Yeah, it's an editorial institute that Christopher Rick started.
Can you tell me about that?
Burnett. Yeah, I think Rick felt, you know, during the culture wars of the 80s and the 90s that, you know, the new criticism and kind of attentive, non-theory-based appreciation of poetry that he had come out of and was interested in fostering as a critic himself, he felt that was really kind of being lost in the English department that he was a part of.
Right.
And I think he felt that by, you know, he had always been an editor, and I think he even said that when he was, you know, at Cambridge, some teacher had said to him, you know, you're brilliant but unsound. Mm-hmm. And what could be a better way to maybe get your feet on solid ground than to kind of become a very meticulous preserver and careful editor of text. And that, you know, and Rich's kind of slogan that he would always say is that, you know, we'll always need dependable texts of good books. And, you know, it's kind of editing is this interesting process where you suddenly realize how much you take for granted. You know, you pick up a copy of Shakespeare and you think you assume that, you know, you're reading Shakespeare as he intended to be read.
Right.
And, you know, you realize a great play like King Lear is a kind of, it's an interstitial of, you know, different folios and quartos, and it's a composite text that relies upon kind of editorial decisions. Ditto Emily Dickinson, ditto, you know, in to some extent, every writer you read, and so it's, you know, you realize that there's always someone mediating your experience of what you enjoy or don't. And that was something that I thought was something that I hope and I aspire to be a great editor of poetry as a teacher in the classroom. And I have the same hopes to be a kind of eclectic and attentive editor as someone who runs a literary journal. But when it comes to the very specific skill sets that Rick's and the Editorial Institute were kind of building and teaching, where it comes to, you know, coming up with critical apparatus and textual variants, mm-hmm. and that kind of, you know, microscopic X-ray vision, it's not something that I am either very good at or feel very compelled to spend my energies on.
Yeah, that's really
so
interesting.
It was kind of, it was something where I, it was a missing hand, so to speak, that I wanted to maybe learn, but it wasn't something that I felt drawn to necessarily pursue or, you know, become a textual scholar, to say the least.
Yeah. Your time in Boston, it sounds like you spent several years there. Can you attribute, because we were talking about place earlier and home, what was Boston like for you? And how do you think it kind of, did it shape kind of your, I don't know, how what was your life like in Boston?
I mean, it's hard to sum up. It was from, you know, basically age 17 to 23 or 24. I spent most of my time in Boston, and in some ways those are probably or will be the most formative years of my life.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I enjoyed it. I'm happy that I don't live in Boston anymore. I find it a little too it's not diverse enough for me in terms of whether it's ethnically diverse or aesthetically diverse or just even when it comes to weather climate, I don't think it's diverse enough. But so it's something that I have nothing bad to say about it, but it's also something that I don't necessarily miss or long for in any way.
And when you got done with, sorry to cut you off, when you got done with all of your schooling in Boston, did you immediately go, was it a no-brainer to go for the MFA and, or did you take some time off? And how many of the poems, if any, that are in the Late Parade came out of that Boston period?
Well, good question. I graduated in 2005 from Boston College. I went back home to New Jersey for about 6 or 8 months. I was working in a bookstore, and then I went to go see John Ashbery give a reading in 2006. And I met him, and I stayed in touch with him, and that summer I ended up taking a job with him, mm-hmm. as a kind of intern houseboy archivist.
Right.
I did that for a year.
That must have been pretty did you see that coming at all?
No, I didn't see that coming, but it was a great, great, hugely, I feel like I'm building a resume here. It was hugely formative, the experience.
Yeah.
But it was, and John was and is a hero of mine. So that meant a lot to me just at all levels. But when I wanted to come up with something to do for a graduate program with the Editorial Institute, I could edit these two unpublished texts of John that he wrote at Harvard as an undergraduate, and then a thesis he did on at Columbia. And so that was something that I could do. There is one poem in the book that I'm actually going to read later that is from my undergraduate years.
Oh, wow.
And it would have been the year I graduated, called The Relay Station.
Yeah.
And that's one of the first poems that I can really remember writing and feeling not that there weren't other poems of mine that I really liked, but it was kind of pointing in a new direction for me, aesthetically, because a lot of what we've been talking about, this tension between the colloquial and the rhetorical and, kind of more alienating, chewy kind of language experience reading or kind of more domestic or interior or quieted autobiographical mood, I felt that this poem kind of started to show that maybe these things weren't so much binary or opposites, but they were something that you could integrate and kind of pedal both sides of the bicycle at the same time.
Definitely.
And so that's one of the earliest, that is the earliest poem in the book. And in terms of my time afterwards, before I went to Columbia for my MFA, I'm not sure if there are any poems from that time in the book. But I know after I finished my master's, I had to decide whether or not I wanted to go on to do a PhD in editing. And a friend of mine, a poet and artist, Simone Carney, she was applying to Hunter. And so I said, oh, well, she's going to leave Boston and kind of go do an MFA. Maybe I should just apply just for the sake of it. And I applied to Columbia, and I got in, and I said, you know what, that's time to go do that. Because I wanted to spend time kind of on my own work.
Yeah.
And many of the poems in the book, I would say more than half, but definitely not all, are poems that I wrote and have been revising during my MFA there.
Why do you think that was such a fruitful time for you? Because I know some students in the MFA, you know, they kind of abandon the work that they do in the MFA. Other people, their thesis is highly part of their first manuscript. What do you attribute that production to?
I think a lot of things. I think moving to the city tremendously energized me. I think the fact that, you know, there's a community of other people who are trying to go about and do the same thing kind of gave a kind of place and ritual to writing, revising, going to readings, reading your work, sharing your work. So it kind of it gave me kind of a contour to my focus. And then in terms of the poems, just kind of being survivable in any way, I think, you know, revision for me was always something that did not come natural. It was something that I kind of treated the way that some of my students would treat a kind of composition paper. You know, you do it in a burst quickly, and then you think of revision as a kind of like just cleaning the table and just making sure you've spelt everything right, and, you know, which means, of course, hitting spell check and then printing out and turning it in. But when I went to going through the process at Columbia of not only having the workshops, which I had done as an undergraduate, but having a kind of thesis workshop where you were kind of looking and living with these poems, and then just the example of my teachers, you know, Timothy Donnelly, Mark Strand, Richard Howard, they're very meticulous and scrupulous readers of poems. And they have high aesthetic standards for, you know, what they think means a finished or abandonable poem.
Yeah.
And, trying to kind of internalize that kind of rigor. And so, and then the funny thing is that even all the poems that were written during that period that made their way in the book, you know, even after I turned in my thesis, the poems are in wildly, they're in wildly different form.
Yeah.
They've just been, you know, I think I did as much revision to those poems after I graduated as I did while I was there.
Yeah, before we jump into the book, you know, the book has gotten an extraordinary amount of attention. And I'm just wondering how Adam Fitzgerald, the person, kind of rolled with that. You know, you've kind of been put in this lineage, whether against your will or not, I have no idea, with kind of like John and Timothy and yourself, and kind of this slow kind of persona has built. And I'm wondering, just, it seems like an overwhelming amount of attention for a poet, and of course a poet, I imagine, that welcomes it. But I'm just curious, now that the book's been out a while, there's been plenty of reviews, you know, kind of looking back now, you know, what has that experience been like on, you know, just that kind of, you know, that spotlight on your work, but also that, does it cause any pressures and the aftershock of that?
I think that I feel tremendously lucky. I feel tremendously thankful that anyone would want to publish it, read it, review it, love it, hate it. I just genuinely feel really lucky, especially because I'm a poet, and I understand that there's a very small commercial platform that takes any interest in spending time with poetry. And there's a very loyal, intense, in some ways, I think the most committed readership for poetry. But it's also, again, it's a small, relatively speaking, it's a small kind of readership that you're dealing with. So at the same time that I feel so grateful and honored, I can also very easily put it into perspective, and it doesn't feel overwhelming or too surreal, because I think the fact that my book was reviewed in the New York Times, which obviously was tremendously gratifying, and that it was reviewed favorably, it's also something that I know probably has exists in some ways more in the perception of other people thinking about my work and myself,
right,
than it can really for me. Because, you know,
well, I mean, after all, you're Adam, and you wake up every day.
I mean,
you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
but it doesn't.
Yeah, I certainly don't feel, I certainly don't feel famous. I certainly don't feel, I don't feel anything, I think, much different than exactly what's happened. It's just kind of a tricky place, because on one hand you can sound kind of hollowly modest,
right,
and on the other hand you can sound kind of blindly arrogant, and I don't find either option really too appealing. But I'm very grateful for anyone who's been interested in the book, and I think my editor and the people at LiveWrite and Norton who designed it and worked on it and promoted it, they did an unbelievable job on their part. That makes me look good. I feel very grateful for that kind of dedication.
Yeah, it's really,
I mean, I sound like Miss America now. It's kind of so gross and kind of sick.
I'm going to come in with some like complex political problem that no one can answer. But hey, you know, it's just a gorgeous book as an object. Even the cover has a texture to it that almost feels edible. It's really,
yeah, I'm with you on that.
It is really crazy. And just the beautiful colors. So why don't we, let's jump into this book, and read a couple poems out of it.
Sure.
Let's go ahead and you mentioned the relay station earlier. Why don't we start with that?
Sure. The relay station. We sleep in private homes now, forgetting the laundry or whomever's name. Snow comes in blankets. Nothing about the outdoors being lonely, except it's the outdoors. The same ones are opened. Piles of ghosted marginalia end up at the end where they belong. A cord or two's tangled. Song drift. Soon, even sooner than that, what's cooked inside isn't dark in the sense of darkness, but resting like the uncle we love's hat. Wide tracks of things we've thought about cool into a freeze, waiting to be tracked down one day until a lone key is minted. I or someone else hums, tissues are collected, dust settles. Our trust is newly renovated like faucets since fate set that way. And today, never happening, feels no more an imposter than the rest of us. Something not to be looked on as anything but what fell between a casualty of sorts. Woods or wares, as it were. News comes. Furniture plays furniture. If what we exchange rumbles in too much quiet, then it means this for you. Afternoon grievances or friends to be arranged. Tea steam purring from the kettle almost.
All right, Adam, thank you so much. That was great. You know, when I first read this poem, I just wrote at first, and I don't think it was the most accurate first reaction, but I just wrote strung out. And not in a context of drug use, but what I was really kind of thinking I was getting at was that quiet sort of sadness in the routine of things. And that it's interesting how, well, I mean, one of the music of it kind of contributes to that, but the way the snow comes and then the news comes and things like whoever's name and just this kind of accumulation of dust settling, feels no more an imposter. There's this kind of just eerie quietness to this poem that is really, really incredible. And then to end on tea steam purring from the kettle almost, there's this kind of domesticated, the scenes of domestication that are just haunted almost at every turn. It's really a really beautiful poem. And we talked about this poem a little bit earlier that, you know, for John Ashbery, and it sounds like a weird question, but when we as poets say a poem is for someone, you know, is that typically arrived at, you think, after the poem's been written? You know,
yes.
I'm always curious about what we mean when we say a poem is for someone.
I think for me it's kind of, it's definitely after the fact, and it's maybe a gesture of, it's hopefully a gesture of gift or goodwill that maybe you're just saying it to yourself, but somehow it feels right. And this was, like I said, this was a poem that I remember writing after I had first started reading John's work. And, I felt like, the example of John had allowed me to, find a different voice that maybe was the voice I wanted. And so I kind of wanted to honor that, not just in this poem, but also, you know, just, his example as an artist and his generosity as a friend and mentor.
Yeah. Yeah. It is almost like, I think some people read those poems that are to somebody as if it's specifically like, I don't know. Like, I like the idea that it comes afterwards, who the receiver.
Yeah, I think that if I can be very semantic about it, I think two and four are very different.
Precisely, yeah.
Very different other prepositions. I mean, this is embarrassing.
Don't go there. Don't do it. Because, well, people who have dealt with language all their lives and who it comes easily for, you know, grammar is kind of one of those weird things. Like, I know it when I see it. I know when it's like, oh my gosh, independent clauses, you know, dependent clauses, Thomas clauses, what? But it's funny that you brought up the difference between two and four, because the next poem I'm going to have you read is not for a shepherd, but to a shepherd.
That is true.
And that's on 82.
To a shepherd. May you have rings of coral groves and all the bread that proves man does not live on, let alone. May the starkness of inhuman instruments be yours, tempering a passageway through this ordinary mountain range where the mountain door dwells. In it opens all the new and old world problems. Preferably there will be respite, civilization slop, its grand mulberry, a withering spa by the sea. May you know sprightly pickled strings that throb like gentle adversaries underneath encroaching sighs, with soft, sweet splashes of blood matter and ground matter, smooth, untimbered song. For always in my registering of life, someone else's, I come to a nestled ridge below a city gridded view and dabble in thoughts that others poach unbeknownst to less literal things, like who just died. So a vague ceremony babbles in my brain. May you have chocolates in muffled form. May you feel ecstatic and hollow-eyed for once as you plead for a microstyle of fleet-footed driving among hills, beeping a sheep-dispersing horn, checking every so often to see who's written, who's marred or married, which season ululates its high temple prayer all alone. May the garrets and flower slums contain ink and silk to last a war or two. May brute force lacking its little stupidities be like the little rain. May your shirred head still be full with sleep. Or, as the wind rips its fur's fuzz mane on rivers and wagons afar way off, wrapping itself into a golden ball, may you always have an elsewhere to hurry to, wave-like, unperfumed, passing.
Thanks, Adam. This is just one of my favorite poems. It's just gorgeous. It really is. And I found it so interesting because I've been reading a lot about the pastoral tradition and to a shepherd, and your line that the shepherd would be beeping a sheep dispersing horn. It's just crazy. I love it. And the chocolates in muffled form. It's really an accomplished poem. It really is just beautiful. What can you say about it? What was this poem for you?
Well, I started corresponding for about 2 years with a person who lives overseas who's actually a shepherd. He's also a soldier. And he had sent me even a picture of him kind of herding his sheep in his Jeep.
Wow.
And so that kind of supplied a little bit of the beeping of sheep dispersing horn image that you spoke about.
Right.
And he kind of lives in a very kind of war-torn place of the world. And so this poem is a kind of more stately, a formal address that kind of knows that poetry might not make anything happen, but that almost that there's hopefully a certain kind of dignity in just kind of saying a prayer out into the world, almost as if it can kind of be a spell of good wishing, but at the same time, maybe it can be honest about the incongruities of a person's life or experience or what they've suffered or what they will go through or what they deserve and will never get.
It is really a beautiful poem. I mean, I'm just so happy you talked about it in the way you did. When we were thinking about the difference between the conversational and the more high rhetoric, and I noticed this, I mean, where would the high rhetoric be without adjectives? I sometimes wonder, you know, it's just, they're so wonderful. But I grew, like, a lot of times in my early formations as a poet, I was very much told all the time, like, oh, those adjectives. Now, adverbs, I definitely have an issue with, but adjectives are sometimes so needed. Have you ever wrestled with this idea of using adjectives?
Yeah, I mean, I'm addicted to them, obviously, and I'm indulgent, and I'm kind of, you know, all the adjectives I could use, baroque or decadent. I mean, I'm drawn to that, and hopefully hopefully I can survive that. I mean, I feel like the adjectives, they're the tissue and coloring of poetry. They're kind of what gives it both its flavor, but also its kind of shade and temperature. And I'm obsessed with the powers of juxtaposition and the kind of magnetism that can happen by putting one word in front of another.
Oh yeah, and adjectives just unlock those portals. Big time. So we're going to turn to the last poem in the book, and the title of the poem is "The Late Parade." Was there Anything you wanted to say before you read this? It's quite a long poem, and I like sometimes poets to read their long poems for us because we rarely get the opportunity to hear them. Is there anything you want to say before you read it?
No, actually, I think I'll just read it.
All right, go for it.
The Late Parade. A glitter in the dromedary dawn with cold rubles. The old cyclone boasts, come what come may, sir. Like a silly curlicue, for instance, that you called August. It, too, had a way, prescient and plunderable. A mix of corsage and assemblage, or coconut, if you can imagine it. A wax cylinder in the wind was carrying us chevalierly through the alphabets of petite longing, or gumption of restless itching. If we stop here, it's because here it's thick dusk, streaming ribbons from the sun, yellow fields of sky matriculating without thinking. Slowly the aperture goes bronze, squinting in the marble harbor, guffawing, crocheting speech. The morning buildings are air, sugared with stiff upper lip. Clipped romance butters our pockets with comic book accents, talked lingo, and perfumed lint. Yesterday, the dazzlement washed us away, like laundry boats bedraggled toward a ventilated hexagon at sea, its coils and plungers, its plumber's tape amid lulling processions of joggers. One spring patios for rodeos, niggled with iodine figures, weave tapestry inside vast tuileries. But that reminds me, how exactly do words form brittle histories? Rummaging a basement heap, a guttural section, suppose, or an anatomical plane, a slice of what should be and has been said but wasn't, like some yogurty radio static, giving way assuredly to sweet hosannas. We bench press archways with our eyes, recalling a time when we actually had eyes. Yes, that was eons ago. Gazing inside at TV bunkers as shock and awe hunkered down for supper, a roseate, ghostly assembly line, producing the bruise. I could use a good one, come to think of it. And nickeled and dimed, halter top waters rise, ferries aglint with restaurant dementias, some happenstance meant to be talked about. We'll have to let be without a doo-wop and haughty pince alone here in the river walk, you buoy it all. You walking sick or emptier in a crowd, though not as empty as one. Amateur, I'm watching your survey shrug to the ground, dear and ruthless. The fiesta has begun, and waffling in the breeze, this is the time to reprogram an ideogram or two, slipping pants off for stoic sleepiness. Dreams have the following architecture, metallic substance, pursuant laws of mineralness, vague plunder of booty, plastic robe of pearls, sesame pirates of our wonderfully dull childhood, where a perverted man usurps your surname and wanders the lawn, sprinkling reindeer tears. Just as to love is to doze, so what I crave is to nose about. I, however, in 17th century fashion, stare at your chaps of frolicking gold, apparel that includes a spigot, which cargoes some mumbling grudge in its hull quarters to Tribeca. There we can arrange a spotted coordinate for the star, a straight path that was kindred, mortal. Now resume the pose. Walk, rub, walk. It only takes a brochure in your palms to let me see native Indians and corpulent Africa's open gently your cornet wrists, your marigold clumped brow. People should be able to account for something in what they desire, where they roam for air, secluded under western bandanas. This leads to reclusiveness, extreme passivity, pus ochre, and the like. General spiels of uneasiness. I should know happening to be one myself, a curmudgeon crayfish like Fantomas. A board was laid out. It had your legs on it, suspended scissor-like, a mode I knew from albums. Speaking of which, one bum was overheard saying to the other, I like your bum. Quite moving mumbo-jumbo, really. One door slices us to the next. The tunnels funnel us into faraway space with pristine shops. You snicker to friends across absolute distance. They always ask me the fable of my life, the accurate one, replete with liquid bones to pick at or throw as testimony. I prefer sassafras to creme brulee on any given day. brutal and cunning but unknown, I love cyclists. So a cloud curtailed me, and I awoke horizon. The result of such expressiveness cannot be denied, especially honey. Figures of rain buttressing cheeks with small change, contingencies do. And this mosaic, a Giotto chapel, we'll name our stone-braced embodiment. Neither reconditioning nor resurrection needed to become the possible. You once told me, first giving up. Give up what? A stripper made in toothy and caustic. Boring. We were literally boring holes in spy stations. Calling us all a pipe dream, a.k.a. yourself. A something for our lips sandwiched in stairs stuck in porta-johns. This kind of looking isn't seeing. This kind of consumption is blindness. An igloo rug. It's not enough to be relative to example and talk art for the dear and near to us, picking up the phone one day, saying clearly but only, and I take refuge in each skittery movement and moment I'm given when not forced to dwell on a monument. Iron's the last bastion afforded to a materialist state. Next to gentle gardens for a bit, we argued. Polluted scales were a kind of resolution to wrestle us from ourselves. Though I kept noticing the way our lips pinched themselves accidentally, how vanity roped around our waists, delicate and burnt, as if dread had come into the room with a waltz on our breast. At such gestured pace, you induce a sigh. Yes, you ignorant child, those fireworks were yours. This time they were. Pyrotechnics fade, experiments not talked about until today in the sky rise of cabinets and windows of papers clustered from sunlight, rise like a goth girl costumed in hardened beeswax whose tattoo reads, buried on the breath of dawn. Wonder needed, atois needed, monkey brains optional. Suitors needed, comforters needed, lactose tolerance optional. Spray-painted suits, undulating lanterns, scenes of frantic night, all for a checkbook that I would seize before surrendering my love of the real. One who will be for the future, if only to turn back his long and lined head with remorse code, acknowledging acknowledgments. Like a magnet, we drifted in a boy's blink for years, not knowing we were drifting. It is always dusk here. Mechanical animals wait for us. We wait for each other. Berry-eyed and bituminous, the tortoise of waiting and wanting, mating and prey mantising. So what are you really interested in, Pythagoras? Things as they are judgments. Careful, the truth's a pill, so chew before swallowing. Maybe it's just a Trump-Lale effect on second thought. Even so, it is what it is. And what it is, we must swallow. And we do. We do.
Adam Fitzgerald, thanks for joining me on New Books and Poetry.
Thank you so much for having me.